KALW.
Islam was part and parcel of what became not just our African-American culture, but our American culture.
How did Islam first arrive in North America?
The background, the context of that spiritual change is the building of social, cultural, and political institutions, which makes sense of that change.
We hear from scholar Edward E. Curtis about the history of Islam in America.
African Americans never thought of themselves as completely cut off from Africa. And so by converting to Islam, they were indeed laying claim to a spiritual, political, social resource that they knew had been part of their people's history for a long, long time.
A special episode from The Spiritual Edge. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Tomorrow, Muslims around the world will be celebrating Eid al-Fitr, marking the end of the holy month of Ramadan. Eid is observed with prayers, friend and family visits, big social gatherings, food fairs, and festivals. Everyone dresses in their finest, and here in the Bay Area, many restaurants will be serving special meals and holding special events. Today, there are an estimated 4 million Muslims in the United States, a 250,000 here in the nine-county Bay Area. So when did Islam first show up in the United States? To understand more about the history of Islam in America and American Muslim converts, I talked to historian Edward E. Curtis, professor of religious studies at Indiana University, in this episode of Becoming Muslim from our project, The Spiritual Edge.
Where in time do you start talking about Muslims in this country if there's like a point where, quote unquote, Islam came to this country?
Well, that's a great question. And the answer is Muslims are part and parcel of the Columbian Age. So after the period of European colonization, or with the beginning of European colonization, we have the first Muslims setting foot on American shores. There are some theories that Muslims may have arrived before Columbus, but most of us who are historians of Muslims in the Americas don't yet find the evidence for that convincing. And so we really see Muslims coming to the Americas at the point of colonization and conquest.
So colonization and conquest, in how many numbers? Like what kind of numbers are we talking about? And from where?
Yeah, so there were likely Muslims with Columbus himself, but on his first voyage. But whether or not that's the case, we're talking about a significant number of Muslims.
And these would have been Muslim slaves, people originally brought for work, to be servants, or what kind of?
Yeah, there were some enslaved people, but there were also free people. And because we have to remember that the same year that Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492 is the same year as the Reconquista, which was the end of a Muslim polity in Andalusia, El Andalus, Iberia, Spain. This is when King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella, you know, sort of ushered out the final Muslim leader there in Granada. There were still many, even though they first banned Jews from Iberia, and then a few decades later, Muslims. There were still Jews and Muslims in Iberian society, and so they were part and parcel of the Mediterranean cultures, and they would have been racially mixed and racially diverse. Islam was not practiced by any one race in the Mediterranean in the early modern period.
And so this would have been a diverse group of Muslims that came over to the U.S. at that time.
Yeah, they wouldn't have looked all one way.
Right.
When we talk about the United States, we're talking about a very different story because we have to fast forward, right, more than a century, right? Because the first, you know, we have with Jamestown, you know, one of the first successful settlements in the British North American colonies, we're talking, you know, the 1600s, not 1492. And so beginning in the 1600s, and continuing through 1808, which is the official ban of the slave trade according to the U.S. Constitution, and then perhaps some illegal movement after that, we have the importation of African-born Muslims in the United States mm-hmm. and the British 13 British colonies. The minority of African-born people who came to the United States were Muslim. Mm. The majority, the vast majority, were practitioners of African traditional religions, Orisha-based religions. Mm. And really, most African-born and indeed African-American people are practicing those religions until after the Civil War. It's not until after the Civil War that the majority of black people in the United States become Christian. So one of the stories that is sometimes told is that, oh, well, most of these early enslaved people were Muslim. They weren't. And it's important to say that because I sometimes worry that there is a desire to claim more numbers and an erasure of African traditional religion, right? About 10% of the enslaved African people were Muslim. There were around 12 million people who came to the Americas during this period, only 400,000 of whom landed in the United States or the 13 British colonies. Most enslaved African people went to the Caribbean or to South America.
And so you said that after the Civil War is when these kind of forced conversions began. Can you talk about that? What was the thinking behind it? What was the process like?
So, the typical Muslim in the United States who lived in South Carolina or Georgia, probably along the coast there, where we have the best evidence of the continuity of Islam in the United States. Oftentimes, it was not a forced conversion, but a natural process of a transition as the black church became what W.E.B. Du Bois called a nation within a nation. After the failure of Reconstruction to establish racial and social justice in the United States after its failure and the implementation of Jim Crow and its perfection in the 1890s when the Supreme Court said it's perfectly legal to have a racially segregated country, the black church emerged as the premier, not just religious institution, but political and social institution in black America. You want to do business, you want to get educated, it's the black church you go to. And so it was then that for various reasons, including cultural, religious, and spiritual ones, people really joined en masse. And it's because of that that black Americans remain the most Christian of any racial group in the United States, more Christian than whites, more Christian than Asians, more Christians than Latinx people. But what we're talking about really when we're talking about religious conversion is we're talking about the building of institutions. Mm-hmm. Even though people may narrate their conversion in terms of a spiritual change, right? The background, the context of that spiritual change is the building of social, cultural, and political institutions, which makes sense of that change. Mm.
You know, at that time after these, so were there any mosques at all?
So one of the reasons we know about Muslim life in the United States is because in the 1930s, workers for the Georgia Writers Project went to people who were part of the Gullah Geechee culture on the Georgia and South Carolina coast, but in particular Georgia. And they did extensive oral history interviews. And in those oral history interviews, many of which were with women rather than men, we found out about the continuity of traditions. And sometimes these traditions that had come from Islam, like praying to the East, it may have been that people continued to pray to the East even after they converted to Christianity. So those were part overall of the African-American culture of the Sea Islands. Mm. And so the meanings, you didn't have to be Muslim to participate in that. But but Islam was part and parcel of what became not just our African-American culture, but our American culture, even after it became divorced for some people from Islamic theology and a organized Muslim community. But there's no evidence of a mosque.
Mm-hmm.
We know we had that in Bahia, Brazil, where there were more Muslims. But there's no, you know, there's just no evidence of a mosque. We had Muslims writing, continuing to pray. Mm. We had fathers and mothers sometimes passing along their Muslim culture and including the knowledge of how to pray to their children. Mm. We had people writing the Quran and Maliki jurisprudential manuals. And what that means is that writing a law book from West Africa, which happened in the Americas from memory. Mm. But in terms of an organized community, there wasn't that. And that's why probably in the end, Islam slowly disappeared as a kind of intentional organized community. It was not passed along from generation to generation in the kind of communal setting that you need in order to continue an organized religion.
And this kind of dissolving happened around when, if we're thinking about timeline?
Yeah, so after the Civil War.
After the Civil War.
White people started converting to Islam as early as, you know, the first decade of the 1800s. They were sailors in the U.S. Navy, and they were fighting the Barbary pirates of North Africa in the United States' first foreign war.
Mm.
And they would sometimes be marooned or they would be captured. And some of them, quote unquote, turned Turk, which means they became Muslims. They converted. They turned Turk. And that's a very important English saying, because what it means from the very beginning of the Republic, converting to Islam was associated with a kind of not just religious betrayal, but a national betrayal. And so when these sailors turned Turk, they abandoned not just their religion of Christianity, they abandoned their country, the United States.
That tie between religion and patriotism that we hear today.
It is a long-standing theme, one that some people think may have just come about after 9/11 or in particular after the Donald Trump phenomenon, but it is part of our shared history as Americans.
Mm.
You're listening to Becoming Muslim, a series from KALW's The Spiritual Edge Project. You can hear more great conversations about faith and spirituality by subscribing to The Spiritual Edge on your podcast player. Now back to my conversation with historian Edward E. Curtis.
So white people also converted at that time. And so the next period would be, would it be immigration?
Yes. Yeah, so we have tiny numbers of conversions, in particular from white folk who become Muslim in the 1800s until after the Civil War and during the period of immigration. It coincided with the spread of a global metaphysical religion movement which saw Islam as part of the wisdom of the mystical East.
Hmm.
And this is when the first very prominent people, VIPs in American culture, converted to Islam. And that's a story that starts with the U.S. consul to the Philippines, Muhammad Alexander Russell Webb,
mm-hmm.
who converts in the late 1880s. He's a Democratic newspaper man. I mean, you can't get more Democratic political establishment than Alexander Webb.
Mm-hmm.
And he converts to Islam. He's not the only one. So that by the 1890s, we have a couple different mosques being run by white converts in New York City, missions that are trying to convert Americans to Islam. And they're mostly going for other white people, middle class, respectable people. They don't want to. They are being a good, you know, Democrat from the 1890s. Alexander Russell Webb was not invested in making Islam a religion of color. And he said he wanted nothing to do with the Muslims who had immigrated to Manhattan, you know, the Syrians, the Bengalis, the other people who were already practicing Islam there, the Tatars, who were already practicing Islam there. He was making it a respectable religion.
A white religion.
A white religion.
A white religion. You said they were drawn to kind of the mysticism. Is that, does that mean Sufism, or like what part of Islam? Is it Ahmadiyya? Is it Sufism? Do we know?
Yes, we do know. So during this time, Americans were exploring religious alternatives to Roman Catholicism and Protestant Christianity. Mm. And you could really, in some ways, date their metaphysical religion to the musings of Thoreau and Emerson, who were writing before the Civil War. Mm. But it really came to flower after the Civil War in a variety of mystical, spiritual movements where people would go in and out of them, but they were oftentimes connected. And these included Madame Blavatsky's Theosophy movement and the Ahmadiyya movement, certainly certain strains of Sufism, and Buddhism, Hinduism. I mean, this is the time when the first yogis were coming to the United States, right, and teaching yoga. And so it was, these were people who were looking for spiritual alternatives in the Gilded Age, spiritual alternatives to Christianity.
Mm. And you said he wanted to distinguish himself from the immigrants and definitely then from the Black Muslim communities as well then, right?
That's right. Black mm-hmm. and Native and Latinx people. He wasn't interested in converting them. And that's one of the reasons he failed. Because as we now know, having, you know, looking back into history, we know that Islam really took off as a religion of converts in the United States in the 1920s among people of African descent.
Okay. And what is that story? Because it's a big gap in time between the last time Africans were practicing Islam and now, you know, kind of converting back to Islam, if that is the way to say it.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think people may think of this sometimes as an all or nothing proposition. That is the sort of all proposition, which is, well, Islam never died. It kept going in the United States, and African Americans who reverted to Islam, they found their way again. And then the nothing proposition is, oh, there was no memory, nothing of Islam left. And this was all created whole cloth. You know, this African-American fascination with Islam. And I think what that doesn't understand, what both positions don't understand, these two extremes, is that African-Americans in the 1920s, just like African-Americans in the 1800s, never thought of themselves as completely cut off from Africa and its history and its heritage. Mm. And so by converting to Islam, they were indeed laying claim to a spiritual, historical, political, social resource that they knew had been part of their people's history for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the 1920s, a variety of groups which called themselves Muslim, sometimes inspired by Muslim missionaries, in particular from Sudan,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes inspired simply by people who had created new denominations, completely new interpretations of Islam, they began to take root in Black America in particular. And those organizations, even though they never supplanted the supremacy of African-American churches, right, they became very important parts of Black society. In the 1920s is the decade during which Islam had always been part of America, but this is when it becomes a typical American religion, in that the congregation becomes the central part of communal life around which everything else revolves. By the 1920s, that's when we have the mosque building program and temples. They called them temples. They called them centers. Sometimes they would rent space in downtowns, whether it would be Indiana Avenue here in Indianapolis, where I'm speaking to you from, or in New York City, or in Chicago, or in Detroit. And the foreign-born immigrants, mainly from the Ottoman Empire, this is when they were also building their first mosques.
Mm.
We have a number of different charismatic leaders who established different forms or communities of Islamic practice. One is Ahmadi. One is Moorish Science Temple, another is Sunni, And the immigrants are also establishing a Shia community, although African Americans don't join that, but there's also a Shia community. And there are people marrying into that Shia community, white women in particular, and who are practicing Shia Islam in the 1920s. Wow. So we have really the basic denominational diversity that we find today among Muslims in the United States, we had it in the 1920s. Those communities compete for converts. And one, after World War II, became so important and so pronounced that it seemed to have eclipsed all the other denominations. And that was, of course, the Nation of Islam. But what we have between World War I and World War II, between 1920 and, you know, and 1940, is we have enormous diversity among Muslim convert communities.
The idea of Black Americans kind of moving towards Islam, was that also, you know, in another breath, a form of revolt, a form of pushing against something else? You're going towards something, but you're also pushing against, you know, a narrative, or you're pushing against something you were forced into. Like, was it reactionary?
Well, it's a revolt. I wouldn't call it reactionary, because that's sometimes associated with regressive politics. And this was a radical politics of Black self-love. This was not regressive. And the answer is, sometimes people presumed in the early studies of the Nation of Islam in the 1960s that there was very little religious motivation for the conversion of Black people to Islam through the Nation of Islam.
That it was
the motivation
political.
Was, yes, exactly. It turns out it's both, and it's always been both. From the 1920s onward, Islam was definitely seen as a political force of anti-colonial, you know, of resistance to white supremacy, to Christian domination, to second-class citizenship, all of the above. And it's not or, it's and it was seen as a spiritual resource and as the truth, as the truth. So that when you read the conversion narratives of people from the 1920s until today, one of the things that many converts will say is that I opened the Quran, I started reading it, and I felt like it was the truth. It was the most convincing version of religion that I had found. That is something that's constant. That has not changed. It's just been underreported and understudied, because it seems like, because it doesn't make sense to people, why in the world would people leave Christianity for Islam, right? But that is what people are telling us, and it's now almost a 100-year-old narrative that they actually have spiritual and theological reasons for converting to Islam in addition to the bid for political liberation. And they see many people of color who have converted to Islam, see Islam as a solution not just to their political and their religious problems. They see it as the answer, as the solution to a better life in all ways. There are also a lot of white people who convert to Islam. And I mean, they're not reclaiming Islam as some form of Nordic heritage. That's not that's not what's going on. But remember that for them, the Islamic teaching that we're all born Muslim and we're made something else is very potent. That our fitra, that is our nature, is to be Muslim, according to mainstream Islamic theology. And so they are returning to who they were intended to be by God, how God had made them.
That was my conversation with historian Edward E. Curtis from the series Becoming Muslim, part of the Spiritual Edge podcast. Jeb Sharp is the editor, Tariq Foda is the engineer, and the executive editor is Judy Silber. Funding for the Becoming Muslim series comes from the Templeton Religion Trust. If you'd like to get in on the Eid al-Fitr festivities this year, we've got a link to some Bay Area events at klw.org. Also, we'll be off for Eid tomorrow, but we'll be back Thursday at 11. And Eid Mubarak to those celebrating. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.